Our subject today, karma, is really one of the most interesting, fundamental, vitally important aspects of the spiritual path to get a strong grip on, because it basically is the difference between whether we perpetuate our own unhappiness-causing actions or whether we take with the sword of discrimination and cut the threads that tie us to our own suffering and liberate ourselves from these delusions. I know Swamiji wrote a small book not too long ago. It was called Sadhu Beware. It's sort of an odd title, but where it comes from is a sadhu is a monk or a renunciate who's given his life to God. And there's a well-known story of a great sage called Ramakrishna, and this monk came to Ramakrishna and was explaining basically that, yes, there are certain rules about how you should behave as a monk, but I don't follow all of them. I just do more what I feel to do. And specifically in this case, the man had formed this alliance with this woman and he was meditating with her. And Ramakrishna didn't correct him in any way. He just said, well, sadhu, beware. And not long after, the monk ran off with the woman and, you know, renounced his renunciate lifestyle. And it wasn't a comment on whether or not you should be a monk or a householder. But what it was a comment on is we can't just lightly play with these principles, because they're principles that are not a matter of opinion or anybody's desire of how we would like things to be. It's just a simple statement of that which is. That's why we call this teaching self-realization, because it's simply realizing the nature of who we really are. And it's not a creation. It's not a matter that we have to invent a new self. It's that we simply have to understand who we really are. There are so many analogies given in all the scriptures of waking up from the dream of this world, and this world is not what it seems, and we dreamed ourselves to be these egos when in fact we are the infinite spirit. And it's so interesting about spiritual teaching. The Bhagavad Gita itself has a verse which I've always found so helpfully instructive. It talks about the stages of ability even to comprehend these principles. And it talks about when, at first, when the soul or the incarnated being, the jiva is the right word, the jiva, the individual in material form, hears about these teachings. He doesn't, that these words are spoken. He doesn't even know that words have been spoken. It's as if somebody just slipped into a language he didn't understand and jabbered at him for a while, and then he went on without noticing. Or, and I love this one, when he hears about it, he immediately falls asleep. It's just like, I don't want to know this. This isn't for me. I actually literally, I'm not talking about people who come to my classes after a hard day of work, but haven't you ever found yourself really trying to explain something to someone they didn't want to know and they literally fall asleep while you're talking? It's like the soul says, I'm not ready to hear this. You may think I'm ready. You may want to tell me, but I'm just not ready. So you fall asleep. And then there'll come the time where you don't fall asleep, but you listen without comprehension. And then a vague attraction arises, then a profound attraction arises, then a deep desire to understand and plunge the meaning, and finally comes realization. You know, in our time, the fundamental law of karma is really so extremely simple. It gets very intricate in its execution because of what Yogananda brilliantly called the thwarting cross currents of ego, which I'll come back and refer to in a moment. But the principle is very simple, which is it's just cause and effect. It's exactly what they say in science. Every action has an equal and opposite reaction. In other words, even though our bodies give us this illusion that there's all this space between us, the fact of the matter is there isn't. There was a wonderful slide I saw in a presentation given by a man named Dr. Lipton. He's written a book called The Biology of Belief. I know nothing about the book, so I'm not necessarily recommending it. I just heard him speak, and his talk, up to a point, was very interesting. It was very interesting when he was talking about science. And then he just sort of made this giant leap over to consciousness, which, with all due respect, was not his field of expertise. And then I literally found myself uncontrollably sleepy. I had been wide awake, absolutely wide awake. And as soon as he started on his theories of consciousness, which were just simply not as clear as the theories, the understandings that we've been given, I became uncontrollably sleepy and desperate to escape the hall, even though until then I'd been absolutely riveted. But at one point he put this big slide up on the wall for his PowerPoint presentation. And first one was just an ordinary photograph of a small group of human beings. I think it was a family. They were walking across a meadow or something like that. And he remarked that, you know, with the human eyes, when you look at people, this is what you see, group of people walking across. He said, in fact, though, if you depicted them scientifically in terms of what the human body really is composed of, which is energy and emanations of energy and emanations of magnetism, electromagnetism, he said this is what it would look like. And he'd taken each form, and essentially he'd drawn their auras. I mean, I have no idea on what basis he did this. But so each form, you could sort of see it, but it was now a much more expanded sort of emanation of colored rays, and he made everybody a different color. So you had these same five or six figures, but you saw all this energy and light emanating from them, and it kept crossing each other. There was not, this little neat boundary was completely gone. There was all this obvious, continuous interaction. I believe one of these other New Age type scientists talked about the fact that every time we exhale, if you're in the room, then you inhale, other people inhale, you know, what you have actually exhaled. And so we are all at this time becoming one. It's a somewhat, it's not particularly an elevating thing. You know, I can see all of you beginning to breathe very shallowly. You know, don't, please don't. But what they're trying to say is that from a scientific point of view, in a very objective way, they're simply declaring what the scientists of consciousness in the traditions of yoga have always said, which is a deeply interrelated universe. Common sense tells you that it is. But the understanding of that is every action, every thought, every feeling, everything that we do has consequences. We launch this energy from the central point of our identification of ourselves. We launch this energy out into the universe. A kind thought, an angry thought, a gesture, a concerted action over the course of a lifetime. And because the ego, which Master defined as the infinite soul identified with the body, causes us to believe that I am the doer and what comes back as the result of my actions, because of that identity with self, there is always a thread between that which we send out and its long journey through time and space. And this law of karma is intimately connected to the law of reincarnation, because we observe, it's easy to see how many scoundrels, you know, get rich and get away with it and die happily in their bed. And how many seemingly innocent people are just felled by circumstances that feel so unjust. You know, I don't know how people maintain the slightest bit of optimism in life without the concept of reincarnation. Because if you just take it from birth to death, it's a pretty sorry prospect. If you just expand that in the same way that people now are quite convinced that your adult life is the result of your childhood, why not believe that your present incarnation is influenced by the conscious lives that you had before? And that the law of karma is the means by which this is carried forth without going through it metaphysically, but the karma is lodged as vibrations of energy in your chakras, which are a non-physical reality. When you shed your physical body, your astral energy body remains, and the pattern of that body is the accumulated result of all your actions and experiences in one lifetime. It retires to the astral world, and when it's time for us to enter a womb again, it's that astral body that comes in, and then it forms a physical body that is reflective of that pattern. And that pattern is not forced upon us. It's simply the total, sum total, in the most impersonal manner. It's metaphysics. In the most impersonal manner, we have acted and responded, initiated and reacted again and again and again, and it all just makes little patterns. It's like we have a whole collection of pennies, dimes, and quarters in all these little jars. Every time we do something, we drop a coin in, and in the end, you have this balance, and that's what we live with. The problem is, of course, that we don't always remember. And so by the time the energy has gone in this long circle, and finally comes back and hits us in the head, it seems like somebody did something to us. Something unfair has happened. It's not because it is unfair, it's just that we don't remember. And, as our reading said today, it's very complex because of the thwarting cross currents of ego. I was trying to think how to illustrate this today. If you're a big, tough kid, and you're on your bicycle, and you go, you know, barreling down the street, and you have a lot of muscle power and a lot of courage and a lot of verve on your bicycle, and you're a little bit of a mean-hearted kid, but you also have that kind of power that you've developed, and you sail down and you see some other little kid and you kind of flip the wheel of your bicycle and knock that poor kid off onto the ground on his tricycle and then just keep on pedaling. That little kid on his tricycle may jump up and chase you with a stick, but because you have other capacities, you can easily outrun him and just leave him back there, right? The thwarting cross currents, you see. Because on one hand, you're mean, but on the other hand, you're powerful. So you outrun the karma, but that little child grows up, right? And also, the action, that mean-hearted action that all that matters is how I feel and you're not even real, I can just knock you off, you have nothing to do with me. That's a deep misunderstanding inside the consciousness. And even if, because of the power the person has developed, he can seemingly get away with it, it sets up this dissonance. And the more he acts in that way, the more those two forces play against each other. And that dissonant action sort of sails out. And I always think of it as such a giant boomerang. That's how Trilanga Swami says it in the reading today. It's this giant boomerang that we've sent out. And we can outrun it for a certain amount of time. This is talking incarnations. But it still is out there. And in the meantime, as long as the sense of I identification is still strong, then that's the thread that ties us to that. And sooner or later, in this extraordinary manner, that can only be understood from a very elevated state of consciousness. This is what Swami writes today. The masters aren't looking from the inside of the knot. They're looking from above, and they can see it. And then we're just walking along, and for no reason at all, somebody comes and hits us with a baseball bat, like that. And we think, oh, how unfair, you know? And maybe by that time, we actually have learned a lot. Maybe a lot of other baseball bats have hit us by that time. So we're not quite so mean as we used to be. But nonetheless, all that dissonant energy still has to find its home, its origin point, so that everything can come back to balance. But what we do when that energy comes back to roost is what determines whether we just send another boomerang out again or whether we've begun to understand, even if we can't quantify all the reasons why, we've just simply begun to understand that everything in this world is fair. And maybe that's come to us from deep meditation experiences where we just suddenly realize that there's a benign good guiding this world. It isn't just random, that there's a divine pattern here. And we've watched our own lives enough in ways that we can remember, where either our own wrong actions have come back more quickly. You know, we sometimes at Ananda, we used to speak of good karma, bad karma, and instant karma. Instant karma is very good karma, because instant karma is when you do it and it hits you. This is exactly what Trilanga Swami, this man who was so evil as to try to poison Trilanga Swami, also had the very good karma to get instant karma, because he did this very wrong thing, because he not only was trying to hurt another person, but he was trying to hurt a greatly elevated soul. And this is where in the reading, it's very interesting. It says there was nothing personal in Trilanga's response. He didn't have seen Trilanga Swami himself had now broken that sense of identity. He inhabited a body because the divine can animate, a free soul can animate a physical body, but he's no longer identified with that body. It's an enormous difference. And it's one that we can see in our own lives. You know, some people, you meet them and they're so strongly identified with the things that they've done. You know, they just walk around. Swami Kriyananda himself tells a story on himself of he was at some conference of well-known spiritual leaders and teachers, and he, I'm not sure exactly why, but he invited everyone out to dinner, and he was hosting a dinner. And he said, and people just completely ignored him at the dinner table. There was just no interest in him, even though he'd hosted it. Everybody was wanting to talk about my latest book, my latest project, my latest this, my latest that. Swami wasn't trying to be unkind, but there was just a deeper sense of identification, even with the good work they were doing among these people. And Swamiji said he was just as happy to be nobody in that company. What difference did it make? And in a similar situation, he was at a reception. It might have even been the same event. And he was chatting with a woman he just happened to meet there. And she finally introduced herself and said, "And after they'd been talking for a while, and then she said, and what is your name? And he said, I'm Swami Kriyananda. And she said, but you're famous. And Swami said, well, maybe, perhaps. He said, but why do you say but? He said, well, everyone else that I've met who was famous seemed important. And Swami took that as a profound compliment. You know, why? Well, merely because one has done things that have made one well-known or have benefited others, what does that have to do with me? About himself, Swamiji says, I consider Swami Kriyananda to be merely an event for which I am responsible. I love thinking of it that way. Well, in any case, we can see in the spectrum of the direct experience we have many different degrees of identification with the self and the expression of the individual. And the question that we just have to ask, to what extent can we detach from that? To what extent is it possible to act even dynamically and beautifully in this world without allowing those actions to define who we are? Well, this is the state of the master. When someone complimented Paramahansa Yogananda on his humility, his answer just took the whole discussion to a different level. He said, how can there be humility when there is no sense of self? He said, I killed Yogananda long ago. No one dwells in this temple now but God. Now that's the state of consciousness we're trying to go to, not merely one where we modestly don't feel the need to really claim that, well, yes, it is true that I did it, but of course, you know, like this. But where it simply doesn't occur to us, because we have shifted our sense of identity from this little temporary body that we're living in into one with the infinite spirit. And all of these karmic lessons that come to us, where action, reaction, and all this that happens, it all depends on this deep sense of identity. Why are they treating me like this? In this book that Sadhu Beware I mentioned earlier that Swamiji wrote, very challenging book. It's instructions for how to overcome the ego. And it says basically, very simply, if the law of karma is true, then we are never justified. We are never justified in self-justification. That absolutely everything that comes to us is in perfect harmony with divine bliss. And any reaction on our part that is simply going to perpetuate our suffering. It's very practical. It's not about anything except, well, are you enjoying yourself? Are you in perfect bliss? Can you write as Swami does, no fear, just gratitude, perfect love, one desire for all mankind? Or is there one desire for all mankind except a couple of people who did me wrong? You know? I was thinking recently the fact that all the masters say that we live in this world and it's impossible not to look around and feel irritated by or frightened or frustrated by all the things that happen that seem so unkind and so unfair. I'm not talking about the little daily life we live only, but just on in this planet, which, you know, there's some very low consciousness beings sharing this space with us. They say in the astral world, we get to live only among those who vibrate with us, that the worlds in the astral world are homogeneous vibrationally, and that one can descend by choice to be helpful to others. But dark forces can't invade the space. That's why on one hand, it's a wonderful rest to be in the astral world. And on the other hand, it can be an error and a delusion because there's no contrast. and there's not as much incentive. In this world, there's plenty of incentive, because all around us there's this hammering reality of the lack of perfect harmony and perfect bliss, and we see it all around us. Just a moment, I lost my thought. Oh, I know. And you read in the scriptures that when you realize God and come to a higher state of resolution, all of that sense that the world is unfair, that things are in any way other than they should be, simply dissolves. And I have to admit, a part of me thinks, how could it? And even that you slightly don't want it to, because you don't want to lose that sense of compassion and care for the suffering multitudes. How can it be right to just let that go? So what I was trying to think about it, and I started thinking, well, let's say there was a big mound of sand, and you walk up to that big mound of sand, and because of the complexities of our own mind, we don't see a big mound of sand. What we see is some sort of dangerous person with a band of his cohorts, and those people come and they attack us, and we're suddenly being attacked, and we become very concerned, and we have to fight back, and then we have to get reinforcements, and we have strategies, and they cheat, and we don't like it, and all of these things happen. We experience them. But then somehow the dust clears, and we see it from another angle. And it occurs to us really that there was never really anything there but this bundle, this big pile of sand, but because of what we have inside of us, we've projected all this onto it. Now, again, let's make this realistic. How many misunderstandings have you had with people that gradually when you sort it out, you realize that nothing was ever done to you? You just misunderstood because of previous things that have happened, because of inattention in the moment, because of the careless way they expressed it, because of something they might have done to you in the past, that we project upon a situation something that never actually happened. Now, the highest principles of self-realization are saying that because the infinite soul has identified with the body and therefore embraced ego, the ego distorts our perception of reality. And literally, everything that we see happening here is not what we see. As Paramahansa Yogananda put it, he said, if you could only see the world, see yourselves as I see you, you would realize that you are nothing but infinite light, beautiful light. This was that charming reading that Steve just did for us. Replace these not working sense perceptions that I have, divine electrician, come in and replace the bulbs, fix it. So there comes a point where we realize that whole experience, even of all our incarnations, there was nothing, never anything there except vibrating light and vibrating sound. But because of the conflicting cross currents of ego and all of these identifications and wrong ideas that we got, we project upon it these huge experiences, including that other people are suffering and this one doesn't deserve it and that one doesn't deserve it and this one is mean. In the Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna and Krishna have this discussion. Arjuna doesn't want to go into the war because he thinks he's going to be killing people and people are going to die. Krishna says, that's what it looks like to you. They said, that's not at all what it looks like to me. Krishna says, Arjuna, you go in and hack off the heads of these and you think that soul has died. But I see that the spirit has just been liberated from that form and the spirit just rises up in freedom from that. You know, having courageously faced the challenge that was given to us and died an honorable death, and it just goes on. You see it one way, Arjuna, I see it another, Krishna says. And so I realize that we come to the point, and we've all come to it to a certain extent anyway, and there simply is no end to evolution of consciousness, that we reach the point where we simply look even at all of this incarnation and all of the hurts and resentments and you did me wrongnesses and oh, I'm so sad and self-disappointments, oh, I let myself down. And we just realize it was nothing but light and sound upon which we projected all this other reality. So what is there to regret? What is there to forgive? What is there to overcome? It just is simply gone. Now, there's one last thought I want to say before I leave this. Swamiji has talked, and all the teachers speak of this, that true spiritual evolution happens because we change from the inside. And it's a very deep and important thing to understand. You know, so often what we try to do is we try to change from the outside. We try to understand the mannerisms. We try to get the right wardrobe. We try to get the right vocabulary. We try to behave in the right way. And there's a certain positiveness to that affirmation. But real change, real spiritual growth, is a deep and profound change of perception. And the change of perception comes because within ourselves, to any extent that we do, we disidentify, we cut the threads that tie us so strongly to our separate reality, and we begin to merge into that infinite. And then we simply see everything differently. In the book I wrote about Swami Kriyananda as we have known him, it's all these firsthand accounts of myself and others. There's so many examples that I saw where I thought he was affirming a right attitude. Without going into great detail, one of them was when I thanked him for the respectful way he had treated me for the last 35 years, even though when I started with him, I was in my early 20s, very strong-minded, not always wrong, but often wrong. But not once did he ever relate to me from the point of view of being 20 years older and much more experienced, but always he just took me as my own reality and responded with his without any reference to it. And when I thanked him for that, he appreciated that because he knew it was a right action on my part. But there was just this slight look of puzzlement in his face. I said, thank you for never making any reference or taking advantage or using it as a power position. I didn't say all that because it was unnecessary, but that's what I meant, the fact that you were older than I. And Swami answered this way, I never noticed. He said, I never notice how old people are. He said, age is just the body. The soul's age is utterly unrelated. Swami said, even children. He said, people's reality varies, and the reality of children is different than that of grown-ups. But consciousness is ageless. I never noticed. You see? You see how different that is? Assuming a right attitude versus the inner transformation of Kriya Yoga and all the practices that go with it, where we just simply untie the knot. If we are one with the Infinite Spirit, everything looks a lot different, doesn't it? And all the rules of right behavior, the whole book, Sadhu Beware, is just saying, untie the knot of ego, dissolve the thwarting cross currents, and all those boomerangs of karma, even if they come to you, they're burned up in the atmosphere of divine understanding. The guru inserts himself between the blow of karma and your own life. The guru takes on our own karma for us. Or it comes to us and we say, what does it matter? Swamiji's in the hospital having this serious operation. People all over the world are anxious. What does it matter? Swimming in bliss. That's the promise, the responsibility, and the inevitable destiny of all of us. Shall we hurry there? Shall we drag our feet? Really, we will get there sooner or later, as Swamiji said once. Why waste a few million years in suffering? Let's do it right away. Eventually, Lahiri said, why not now?